discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial X. I'm now here with a regular. It's someone that I think everyone enjoys hearing from each year. Endeavor, welcome back to Millennial.
Thanks for having me back again, Woes. I always enjoy this each year. My joke, which I repeat every year, is this is the Christmas party of the dissident right, or whatever we're calling this year these days. And it's always a pleasure. I think this is my sixth year appearing on Millennial, and congratulations on one decade. It's incredible it's incredible when you say it, but yeah, it's quite the wild ride you've had going on for the past decade.
Ah, yes. I never imagined that it would be like this, but yeah, I'm proud of it, and I'm very glad. It's lovely. I hope I'm doing enough to sort of mark that it is the 10th. There are going to be the hangouts later on. That'll be a unique thing, or at least a new thing for this year. So, and of course, there was the countdown video at the start, which marked the history of the festival. So, it's something I just can't quite believe it. But anyway, enough about that. Let's get on to you and your perception. Oh, I don't know if you want to introduce yourself briefly to anyone who's new to this.
Yeah, so I blog under the name Endeavor. I'm still on YouTube, and I'm also on Substack now. Those are my two main platforms, and I'm also on Twitter, or X as it's called now, and Telegram. So basically broadly right-wing content, stuff related to the dissident rights sphere, more or less.
Right, yes. And, I mean, it goes back to YouTube, doesn't it? I think that was where you started.
Yeah, it does. And I'm actually still on YouTube, so I still upload there. I still get a decent amount of views there. Unfortunately, the growth has stagnated. I'm kind of unhappy that it kind of set an upper limit, but I guess I should feel fortunate that I was one of the few who actually was able to keep their channel. Fingers crossed. Let's hope I don't get taken down. But I've branched out. So I'm also writing for Countercurrents now as well. So my work on Substack is also published on Countercurrents. But I guess I'm a lover of the video essay. That's kind of always going to be the format that I gravitate towards, because that's what I got into this sphere watching. It was these video essays. I do prefer audio content. And of course, I like streams. Of course, I love Millennial. But I think that just a polished 20, 30 minute long video essay on a certain topic, that's the best format, in my opinion. But I know that a lot of people are now into written stuff as well. So what I'm doing these days is writing it on Substack. And then if it's something that I think is substantial and won't get banned from YouTube, then I'll upload it there as well.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I think if you're not banned from YouTube by now, then you're probably safe. I mean, I don't think they're going to, well, then they did ban Keith Woods quite recently, but apart from that, there haven't been any bans really for a long time. So I think you're probably okay. So let's start with, your impressions of 2024.
Well, ultimately, I think it's been a pretty good year. One thing that really struck me about this year is how these various Western liberal democracies really seem to be losing their legitimacy. So what you see is that all of these, almost all of these elections, now I haven't followed them all too closely, but what you see is that the party which was in power previous to the election, a lot of times they're really getting trounced. Like you saw this in the UK, you saw this in the United States more recently. And you just keep seeing that a lot of these, it seems like the electorates in all these countries, they just seem like they're so desperate to try to get rid of whoever happens to be in power at that point. And it's kind of in vain, because I think you and I know that that's not actually going to fix the problem. But it just seems like there's this mass discontent with the situation, with the situation which exists right now. And you really kind of see that boiling over. And then as well with other things. So things like the Southport riots from this year. It was the town was called Southport, right? Was that the name of the town?
Yes. Just before you get into that, let me intervene with a sort of analogy. I remember reading that Churchill, after the war, he got voted out. The public were, I think it was actually still before the, like before the war had ended. I think
the war was still going on when Churchill
yeah,
was
yeah.
there, yes.
And someone, a historian, wrote that this was because the public were so, they associated him with the war. And now that the war was reaching its conclusion, they wanted him out of the way so that they could have a peacetime prime minister. Because even though he had led them and you know, been fairly popular, at least throughout the war, they associated him with bad times, with hardship. And I think in the same way, people now associate all of the people who, all of the figures who've been in charge over the last 10 years, the public now associate them with, well, bad times, because the last 10 years have been so bad. And so there's a sort of clamor to just change the faces who are in charge of us. Even, obviously, that you and I, as you said, it probably won't change much. But I think the public, just like Justin Trudeau, well, you can talk about that. But I mean, I think there's just so much resentment towards the government throughout the whole West that, yeah, a lot of them just, a lot of the public just want them out.
Yeah, like, for example, you'll see that someone like Macron, and I'm no expert on French politics, but his approval ratings are in the dumps. Someone like Keir Starmer, even though he was just elected a couple months ago, his approval ratings are in the dumps. I'm pretty sure that's the case with Scholz in Germany. I know that their government has this disaster on their hands, and there's going to be an election in Germany in a couple of months. In Canada, country where I'm from, the Trudeau government is basically falling apart at this point. So his deputy prime minister, who's also the minister of finance, Chrystia Freeland, she resigned this past week. And half of Trudeau's party is now calling on him to resign, but he's still not stepping down. But when you look at the polls, you see that the Conservative Party is just going to probably get this massive electoral victory. Now, I'm not saying I'm exactly a fan of them. They're probably about the same thing as the UK Conservative Party. So that tells you everything you need to know about them. But you just see this mass discontent with the status quo. And in Canada's case, people are associating that with Justin Trudeau, rightfully so to an extent. I think that some people might assign too much of the blame. I think that the problem runs much deeper than simply the figure of Justin Trudeau, but he's kind of become the face of the discontent that you're seeing in Canada now. And that, it seems like that's typical of the Western world right now. It just seems that no elected politician is doing a good job. It just seems that none of them are popular. I think though people are kind of just lashing out at the figureheads, partly understandably, but I think that the problem is much more fundamental than that. And I'm pretty sure everyone in the audience understands that, but you kind of see with the broader public, it's more just like directing it towards these figureheads at the moment. But it's a sign of the overall mood.
And that's to do with, well, mass immigration is the obvious one, but I think also just the economy,
inflation,
feminism. Yeah, you go through it.
Oh yeah, well, of course, there's all the stuff. There's the tranny stuff. I think that people have really soured on that really quickly. Well, I mean, it's incredible that it took as long, even though it was a relatively new thing. It's incredible that it took people this long to actually sour on that, but. I mean, I see a lot less of that being pushed today, because I think it's something which clearly even some of the most liberal people are opposed to. But then you also have all these other knock-on effects of mass immigration, like the housing crisis. Canada is in particular probably the worst in this regard. But you see in almost all these countries, there's this horrible housing crisis where rent prices are just going through the roof. And well, it doesn't take a PhD in economics to understand that if you massively increase the population via mass immigration, housing prices are going to go up, because you can't build houses at the same rate that you can bring people into the countries. I mean, people like you and I have been talking about the issue of mass immigration for probably the better part of the last decade. But over the past 3 years, I know this is the case in both Canada and Britain, and I'm pretty sure it was the case under the Biden administration too. It just went absolutely through the roof. So I thought that the numbers coming into Canada in 2018, I thought that those were outrageous. But then from 2021 onwards, they almost doubled or even almost tripled. It's incredible when you think of it. But net migration, I don't have the numbers in front of me right now, but they just went up astronomically. I will add, during COVID, this was while Canadians were still being locked down, while they were still being forced to get these vaccine passports, when they were still being forced to wear masks in order to walk into a supermarket. They were importing massive numbers of people. Like they radically increased the number of immigrants entering Canada, and the mood in Canada has really shifted since then. So unfortunately, the bane of the existence of any Canadian right winger, Canada has been the most open country to immigration pretty much in the Western world for a long time, but very quickly the attitude is changing. So you see the most recent polls I've seen suggest that 2/3 of the population want immigration to be reduced, and about half are actually in favor of deportations at this point. So now, again, that doesn't mean that that's necessarily going to happen within the next election cycle, because as we know, the people in power don't give a damn what the people actually want. But it is a sign. It is a sign of a change of the attitudes, and one that's going a lot more in our direction.
I think mass deportation is something that would have been anathema to most people 10 years ago, or definitely like 20 years ago. The fact that that is now a very pretty much a mainstream talking point. I don't know if that's, would you say that's an exaggeration? I think it is.
I'd say it's getting there. I'd say it's getting to that point. I don't think like any of these parties are seriously considering it, but it's entering the discourse in a way that it has never been before.
No, not in my lifetime. It's not been like this. That's what makes me not hopeful, but just sort of curious about this situation. What are they going to do with this? It's like I said, Keir Starmer mentioned all of this in his speech a few weeks ago, that this was deliberate and done against the wishes of the electorate. They were lied to, and so on. I'm sort of bewildered as to why he would say that, because if he now does nothing about it, that's the public are going to see that, and you know, the public have little agency, they've got no organization, sure, but it's just strange for a politician to set himself up like that. Something is going to be done.
Well, I think with the case of Keir Starmer, because it's funny, the exact same thing happened in Canada around the exact same time. So a couple of weeks earlier, Justin Trudeau made a very similar announcement about immigration. But the messaging was the total opposite. With Keir Starmer, he just got into office after, how long was it? How long were the Tories in power? Was it like 14 years or something?
Yes, yes.
Well, he got into power after 14 years of Tory rule. So he had the opportunity to just say, well, it was them who did this. Now, of course, that's not true. I'm well aware of the story of Tony Blair and how radically he increased immigration during his time in office. And I know that there was that famous quote, I can't remember who it was that said it, that they wanted to, that the Labour Party in Britain wanted to rub the right's nose in diversity. Incredible that someone would actually admit to saying that, but
he later tried to roll it back. It was Andrew Nether, who'd been a speechwriter for Tony Blair.
Yeah, incredible.
He said that in a newspaper article in like 2009, I think, and he was talking about the early 2000s. And yeah, but that was an amazing admission.
Yeah, and the thing that's kind of depressing is that the numbers from back then are actually, they're minuscule and compared to what they've been over the last few years, both in Canada and in Britain. And with Keir Starmer, he had the opportunity to just say, well, the Tories did it. It was them who did it, and just kind of pushing the problem off onto them. With Justin Trudeau, he's been in power for almost 10 years now. So he didn't have that opportunity. So the tone of the speech was totally different. So with Starmer, it was, this is deliberate. This was malicious. The people were lied to. And with Trudeau, well, I think his exact quotation was something like, we just didn't get the balance right. we need to just talk about immigration. And the tone of his speech was, you know, we kind of didn't. We just didn't really get it right. You know, sorry about that. You know, just a little mistake. But, you know, we're gonna fix it. Just a little mistake. But
so, my bad.
Yeah, that's pretty much what he said. I think the quote was, like we didn't get the balance right. Oh, gee, I don't know, a million people entering the country in a single year? Oh, just not quite getting the balance right? I mean,
Athletic. And if he'd just listened to an ordinary Canadian, he could have got the balance right. But for some reason, that was just unthinkable.
Well, I mean, for me, the balance right would probably be that same number, but in the negatives.
of course.
But that's neither here nor there. Well, yeah, with Trudeau, he tried to like backtrack on it in the softest, Trudeau, every time you hear the guy speak, it's as if he's talking to a six-year-old child. But he's trying to really kind of backtrack on it, saying, just a little mistake. And, you know, a lot of people have asked why they're doing this. And my theory is that I don't think these people have changed their worldview. I mean, I know that for a fact. Trudeau, Starmer, the entire establishment across these countries, I don't think that they've really changed their worldview fundamentally. I think that what's happening is that the reality of the disaster which they've created is catching up to them. Because, you know, if people like you and I are right about the situation, we're right about what the effects that this is going to have on our countries, well, then, regardless of what your ideology is, if you're someone in power, you're going to have to deal with these issues. And they're creating this disaster, which is becoming unmanageable. Like, I was shocked when I saw the numbers. I was shocked that it was even logistically possible to get this many people into Canada in a single year. I mean, it's unbelievable. But what I think is that it's just putting such a strain on the infrastructure now that they realize that, it just can't go on like this. Now, I don't want to give people too much hope here. So I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. So let's take Trudeau for an example. Now, politically, he's a dead man walking. His party is going to be voted out. They're going to be absolutely crushed in the next election. And he might even fall before that. So there's a chance that he'll be pressured into resigning before that, because his party is just a total train wreck right now. Very similar to what you saw with the Tory party in Britain. And I don't think they're going to get zero seats, but they're going to get pretty close to that. But the policy which he proposed in opposition to what's going on right now. So originally, for example, the plan for next year was to have 500,000 permanent residents entering Canada, and that's not counting the temporary residents, that being international students, a word you can put in quotations in Canada, temporary workers, and then illegals, and then refugees, and all the other ones you add on top of that. But that's an insanely high number. Like, that's over 1% of the population of Canada. Population just passed over 40 million, I think, this year. It might even got to 41. And it's, but I remember a couple of years ago, it was only like 37, 38. It just goes to show how many they've brought in. But the new policy that they proposed is basically a reduction by about 100,000. And then they said over the next 5 years, they'll get that down to about 350, which I need to remind people, that's still replacement immigration. That's still mass migration, and that's still going to cause that's still going to bring about the same outcome, albeit a bit later. So I don't want to get too far ahead of myself in terms of saying, like, well, things have changed, but I feel like they kind of have this disaster on their hands, and they're just kind of having to come around to the reality that they're going to have to deal with it one way or another.
And isn't there a thing about expecting 5 million people to self-deport in the next few months when their visas expire?
Well, yeah. So a huge amount of the people who entered Canada in the last couple of years have been on these temporary visas. So a lot of them are on these student visas or on these temporary foreign worker visas, stuff like that. And yeah, there are a lot of them which are set to expire. And well, then these people would no longer have the legal right to remain in Canada. And then the answer would be that they would have to leave. Again, you know, I certainly hope that that I certainly hope that this is enforced. I certainly hope that they do everything they can to actually force these people to leave. I do actually genuinely get the sense that they realize that like they did that. Not so much so that they boiled the frog too quickly, but more that the infrastructure of the country just cannot sustain what they've been doing over the last couple of years. So
they bit off more than they could chew.
Oh, they bit. Yes, exactly. Yeah. They bit off more than they can chew. All I can say is, well, again, I'm not ready to start to celebrate or anything. I think it's more just time that we have to keep pushing the issue. But hey, I'll take any deportations I can get. I don't know. I'm doubtful that that 5 million people will leave the country next year. But I mean, you could. I wouldn't be surprised if the numbers actually do go down, because there's just a huge number of people in Canada who are there on temporary residencies, who don't actually have a right to stay there beyond their certain visa. So I think there's a chance that a lot of them will leave, but I don't know. I don't know whether I trust the government to actually be forceful to go around and force people to leave. I hope so, but
I mean, the thing is, it has to be mass deportation, because what they've done is they've cranked it up so high, like they've been pumping Canada, let's say, full of arsenic, and now they're saying, but don't worry, now it's just going to be diluted arsenic from now on. So that's better than arsenic, isn't it? Well, yes, it is, but it's just a slower form of the same thing. So only mass deportation, remigration, should be seen as an actual solution here. Anything else, like just less lower numbers of immigrants coming in every year, isn't good enough.
It's not a solution. Yeah. So I need to stress that. We're still in the same situation. We're facing the same problem. It's just that they're kind of slowing down a little because, because they were trying to replace us a bit too fast. The infrastructure was not really in place to replace us that fast. So they're going to kind of do it a little bit slower. But of course, the same goal is still in place. And I couldn't imagine mass deportations happening without a much more drastic change in the system. However, I think the positive is more that, the positive is that the establishment looks really bad right now, and that the various narratives which they've been using over the last couple of years to facilitate this process, these narratives really seem to be falling apart very quickly and losing their legitimacy. So, like one example, and I don't want to put too much stock in social media, because it's not everything, but it's not nothing either. So when you go on X now and you find any article from the mainstream media in Canada and you click on the replies, if it's an article about immigration, all of the replies are going to be about how we need either need less immigration or how we need deportations. And they get ratioed on almost every single article. And this isn't right-wing news sources. This is the mainstream media. This is left-leaning news. This is things like Toronto Star, which is like our version of The Guardian, or CBC, which is our version of BBC. Anytime they come out with an article on immigration, you'll just see in the comment section, at least on X. I don't know what it's like on Facebook. I don't use Facebook anymore, but I wouldn't be surprised if it were the same. You see in the comment section that everyone is just saying, like, we want an end to it. So there definitely is a mood. There definitely is a shift in the mood in that regard. But again, I don't want to be too optimistic about that, because that doesn't necessarily equal results.
See, the powers that be, and we all know who I'm talking about. They've had this goal for decades of basically flooding white countries with non-whites, so as to change those countries permanently, and not just culturally or socially, but genetically. So my question would be, what's going to happen now? Because I don't think they're going to give up on that goal. They want us gone. So I guess the game now is to continue that whilst placating us that that's not happening. Would you say that?
Well, I think that the problem that they have is that they're actually just running into the realities of replacing a first world population with a third world one, that the infrastructure just doesn't work as well. And again, like if you're, regardless of what an elite member's ideology is, their status is reliant on their elite status is tied up with the Western world. And this kind of brings you into what's going on in the United States and what's going on with Donald Trump. Now, I don't want people to misinterpret what I'll say about Donald Trump, because I need to make it clear that he's not a savior. He's not our guy. He's not going to reverse the great replacement in the United States. And he's not going to save the West or anything like that. And because I know that if you say anything positive, you'll get people accusing you of that. And, you know, with Donald Trump himself, I also just think that he has no worldview. He's just, his worldview is whatever puts him in power. Like 20 years ago, he was a liberal. And I think that he just saw an opportunity in right-wing populism to rise to power in 2016. And, you know, he's kind of just kept that aesthetic. What I think is more interesting is who is around Donald Trump and kind of the incentives which they have for supporting him. What's interesting is big tech, how big tech has gone to the right. Would you agree that big tech, it's not nearly as woke, so to say, today as it was 3-4 years ago?
Yes, but I would still say that it's, if anything, I'd say it's centrist now. It's not right wing.
Oh, it's centrist. It's not. It's definitely not right wing. But it has drifted to the right. It's drifted to the center from where it was on the left a few years ago. You know, what's interesting with the tech oligarchs is that it's an industry which requires a high degree of competence and a high degree of innovation. And the problem with the current system, this woke managerialism that is pretty much dominant, which is pretty much hegemonic in countries like Britain or Canada, which is also extremely prominent in the United States, but they kind of have this dark horse in big tech. What's interesting is that these tech oligarchs, they're all billionaires. They've all made a huge amount of money off of this industry. But their status, their business empires rely on the human capital of the United States. And the problem is that woke managerialism, it erodes that by its very nature, because it forces by law companies to prioritize what we call diversity, the DEI, which of course we just mean is anti-whiteism. It prioritizes companies it mandates that companies prioritize diversity over the actual goal of the company. And you see that both in the private and the public sector, like this fiasco with FEMA and these hurricanes in the southern United States this year, where on these conference calls, they're talking about how like LGBT people need to be prioritized in disaster relief or something, or that their mission statement had their commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion above their commitment to actually, you know, responding to disasters. Well, if you incentivize something above if you force an organization, whatever it is, to prioritize diversity over whatever that goal of that organization is supposed to be, you're going to depreciate the actual ability to attain that goal.
You're going to have dysfunction.
You're going to have dysfunction by necessity, because the initial goal is no longer prioritized. With big tech, you're not going to be able to build this technocratic, futuristic world if you're hiring people, if your goal is to hire a black lesbian over someone who actually is competent and actually has the IQ to be able to work in this industry. So, you know, I feel like big tech has kind of gone to the right just because of one of the reasons is just the competence crisis. I'm sure that most people have read that article by, I think it's Harold Robertson, Did you read the one, the how complex systems can't survive the competence crisis?
Yes, I did actually. Yeah, but it was about a year ago.
It came out about a year and a half ago. So it's not a new article, but we actually know that Elon Musk even read this article. He shared it on X. So even someone like him is aware of this. The problem is that's just gonna prevent these industries from actually achieving their goals. Like you take someone like Musk, because his dream is to go to Mars. Well, you're not gonna be able to go to Mars if the average IQ of the United States drops by 10 points. And again, I don't think that Musk is he's certainly not a white nationalist or anything. And I don't even think he's a particularly idealistic guy in regards that he cares about nation or civilization. I mean, maybe he cares about civilization, but maybe on a much more superficial level than, you know, someone like you or I might. But again, though, and again, he's not even from the United States originally, but his business empire and his ambitions are tied to the US. So he's not going to be able to achieve his goals. He's not going to be able to achieve his goals if woke managerialism it basically erodes the human capital of the country. So regardless of his ideology, well, that's a threat to him. And you see this with a lot of guys like Mark Anderson and Peter Thiel and even people like Bezos and Zuckerberg. They didn't endorse Trump, but they said that they're not going to endorse anyone, which to the libtard establishment, that's taken as being an endorsement of Trump just because they didn't endorse Harris.
Colluding with evil in the sense that, well, you're not fighting evil, therefore you must be neutral about evil. I mean, I remember seeing a clip a few weeks ago of an American woman going nuts on a plane. Did you see this?
I didn't see that one, no.
And she and her husband, and you could see that the husband was hoping that she would just shut the fuck up.
Oh no!
But she wouldn't. She kept going, and they got thrown off.
What was it over?
I think she determined that the person sitting next to her had voted for Trump.
Oh boy!
And so it's like a middle-aged liberal woman, and she just wouldn't shut up, and they got chucked off. Very amusing, but I kind of felt sorry for the guy, for her husband, because he's the, oh, you know, Marjorie, what the hell have you done? We're gonna have to get another flight now. It's gonna take another 12 hours. You stupid woman. Oh, anyway, man. It was an amusing wee clip. But here's a question, because Elon Musk, I agree. I think he's exactly as you described. He doesn't care about diversity. He wants success and efficiency. And actually, I just happened to glance at Twitter just now to share the stream, and Morgoth has quoted Elon Musk. Elon Musk is saying that he's talking about a sort of high-speed train in Antarctica, and Morgoth is saying it sounds like the worst thing in the world. Because of course Morgoth has this love affair with the great unknown and the untamed wilderness and so on, and Musk is talking about basically monetizing everything and making everything efficient and everything possible and so on. Well, okay, so Musk doesn't care, but he wants the best people for the job. Fine, merit and all that, and no doubt these other tech tycoons are the same. But the trouble is, for them, the trouble is that will result in large numbers of, I mean, if you do away with all the DEI hiring, you're going to have a very white, East Asian, Ashkenazi Jewish tech sector, and you're going to have blacks basically entirely absent from that. In other fields too. Black people and other races are going to be just absent because they're not competent enough. They're not meritorious enough. So then that lays the ground wide open for all of this to happen again 20 years from now. I mean, the whole woke stuff, because these people are excluded from these high prestige sectors. It's obviously racism. And presumably Musk isn't thinking in these, he does think about the long term, but I think he doesn't realize that this is a cycle that will certainly repeat. And people like him will be held responsible for it because they racistly hired competent people instead of diverse people.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just that the societal implications are that we're unless we awaken to the reality of race and the truths about this stuff, then we're just setting ourselves up for another cycle of this.
Well, that's the issue that if they're actually successful, because, you know, let's not put the cart before the horse. The Trump and his administration and the people around him are actually going to have to be able to implement this because, you know, the whole managerial bureaucracy, it's still staffed by total libtards. And, you know, they'll actually have to wrestle that control away and actually reel that in a little. I don't have any faith that they'll do what it takes to fully dismantle that, but you know, they may be able to reel it in a little. And the point I was trying to get to is I do think that you'll see that it'll probably be less woke, at least Silicon Valley and big tech will probably be less woke in the coming years. But like you mentioned, they do have this issue, which is still going to be burgeoning. Well, for example, the demographic trends are still on the side of the Great Replacement. It's still on the side of wokeness because, of course, you know, the rising non-white masses are not going to accept this idea that they were just less successful.
And well, I mean, look at California and Silicon Valley. So Silicon Valley will be this whiteopia, well, Ashkajapo whiteopia in the middle in the middle of California, which is ever more brown. I mean, the difference is going to be very stark.
Yeah, and again, I don't want to put too much stock in. I don't think that, you know, the masses being angry about something necessarily means that change is coming. But of course, as we know, there are still many very wealthy, very powerful libtards who are going to appeal to these people. They're still doing it, and it's not going away, unfortunately. You know, did you happen to see the interview which Mark Anderson did with Joe Rogan after the Trump election? Did you happen to see that?
No, I didn't.
Okay, because it's very telling of where the heads of these people are. So he talks about a lot of this stuff. He talks about the competence crisis. He talks about wokeism and the Biden administration and then cancel culture. Because this is another thing to consider is that cancel culture, as it's come to be known, is not something which just affects right wingers and people on the internet like you or I. This is stuff which ordinary people face as well. And there have been many examples of very prominent people being canceled because they did a hateism or whatever. So, for example, Brendan Eich, who was one of the founders and CEO and this is former CEO of Mozilla, he was canceled because it was revealed that a couple of years earlier he had donated to a campaign to oppose gay marriage in California, and he was dethroned from a CEO position of a major company like Mozilla. Do you guys?
Yeah, I did a video about that at the time. It was like 2014, I think.
Mm-hmm. And then there's Papa John himself. So the guy who started Papa John's Pizza, he was canceled in 2018 because he said a certain racial slur out of context. So he said, like, in the past, people said this. He said this on a conference call, totally out of context, just uttering this one word. A guy who had built up a business empire over the course of decades was dethroned and kicked out of his own company, which he named after himself by uttering one single word on a single conference call totally out of context. He didn't call someone this. He just said that this is a word which has been said in the past. I mean, it's incredible. Because this is another threat to, again, like, if you're not a dyed-in-the-wool libtard, this is a major threat to you, because if you're this big businessman, you don't have to be this right-winger. The idea that you can be canceled and lose your entire career just in an instant like that, that's a major threat. So, I mean, that's another driving force behind this. But to get back to the point earlier, that's kind of a big detour there. But what you notice in the interview with Mark Anderson on Joe Rogan is that he seems to assume that without wokeism, you're just going to have the 1990s. Or no, you're not going to have the 1990s. You're going to have media from the 1990s. So you're going to have Rocky III or whatever it is. That's what the boardroom of some big tech company is going to look like if you just don't have wokeness. And the other thing that he mentioned in the interview was that the Biden administration had been forcing these tech companies to regulate AI, basically forcing the AI to be woke. And I know everyone has seen this going around the internet now that, like, for example, I did this thing where I asked the AI whether it would rather utter the phrase George Floyd is an idiot in order to disarm a nuclear bomb, which was going to blow up millions of people. And it said that it wouldn't even utter that phrase even to save millions of people's lives. So there's the example of Google Gemini, which wasn't able to draw a picture of white people because, according to the programming, drawing Vikings as white, well, that must be racism. So the Vikings were all black. But anyway, he seems to assume that this is Mark Anderson I'm talking about. He seems to assume that if an AI weren't made to be woke, it would basically hold the ideology of a 90s era liberal. I mean, because he praises Bill Clinton in the interview, even though, I mean, things like the O.J. Simpson trial happened when Bill Clinton was president. I think he was the first president to actually say diversity is our strength or something like that. The guy was woke, just to a lesser degree. But I think the reality is, though, if you had an AI without any ideology, that's going to make these 90s classic liberals, guys who want to get back to whatever, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air or Rocky III or whatever it is, it's going to make them very uncomfortable, because I don't think it's going to sound like a 90s liberal as much as it's going to sound like a 1920s race realist. I think that's what a non-ideological AI would actually sound like. And, well, that's going to make these guys very uncomfortable. So they're going to have to confront this reality, because what their proposed solution to the problem, it doesn't solve the problem. And it just kind of it's just kind of a way of, like, begging the problem to go away, which it really won't, unless it's actually solved. So they're going to run into these problems if they're actually able to get their way. They're going to run into these problems.
I think their solution would probably be to have the AI just sort of phase out when any topic like that comes up, and say things like, the data is so complex that nobody can draw any conclusions yet. Very fuzzy picture. Nobody knows. Because that would avoid saying anything. You know, and it would certainly avoid sounding like a 1920s race realist.
Yeah, I don't know what they're going to do with that, because will they actually follow the advice of the AI? And I don't know the answer to that. Would someone like Musk, who, as we know, he's the 90s era liberal. I know it's kind of a cliche to say. We've been using this phrase for the better part of a decade now to describe the center, I guess we can say. I wonder if someone like Musk actually entered these questions into an AI. How would he react to that? Would it actually get him to change his worldview? I mean, I know that most people don't change their worldview when they're confronted with facts. I mean, for example, the issue of race realism, these facts have been established for decades now, and that hasn't had an impact on policy whatsoever or on the opinions of the majority of the population. I mean, hell, even most people on the right don't even believe in these ideas, even though, well, the facts are there. So I don't think that simply showing somebody the facts is going to get them to change their mind. But would an autist and like Elon Musk, who's obsessed with technology, how would he react to that? That's a question I don't know the answer to.
I mean, obviously, you've got to remember that Elon Musk is not a robot, so he can. I can imagine him having just enough social, social news to realize, well, the AI is telling me this because the AI is telling me that everyone's equal because obviously there are things we can't say publicly. But I know the truth that, and I know who I'm going to hire. But I understand why the AI is telling me a load of rubbish. I can imagine him being realistic enough to realize, to understand that. But I don't know. Go on.
Well, the other proposed solution that these guys seem to have is to bring in immigrants who are of a higher level degree of competency. So instead of, and we're talking about the United States in this regard. And so instead of allowing a bunch of Hondurans to pour across the border, you're going to ship in people from China or India. You can look at Canada, and we kind of have had that for the last couple of decades. So the quote unquote diversity in Canada, I mean, it's not, it doesn't result in as much crime per se. So you'll still get more crime from immigrants, but a lot of them are from East Asia and they don't tend to be the most criminal. I don't want to go on to this topic too much, but let me just say Canadians at this point don't have very high opinions of Indians and South Asians in particular. There is a lot of discontent with this particular demographic, which I've written about on Substack, but not wanting to go on into that too much because I know that you're located in Britain and that would be that would not be very appropriate for this stream. But
well, okay.
Yeah. Well,
go on. That's all right. I think it's okay. But you can say what you want. Just don't use racial slurs. Which I'm
okay, sure. The issue with Indian immigration, like in Canada, it's not even just like the crime stuff. It's not even just like the low IQ stuff. Because a lot of them are very high IQ individuals. I mean, but with Canada, we get so many. We get like the entire. It seems like we get the top to the bottom cast. So we have like the low IQ ones, the high IQ ones. It just seems like they're all from India. But the issue isn't so much that they're like not like with even the high IQ ones. The issue isn't so much that they're not competent. It's just that the mentality is just so, it's so alien to what we're used to in Canada. I wrote an entire article about this about food banks in Canada where, you know what a food bank is? It's a charitable organization, which,
yes.
It gives out food to the poor. So what you do is people bring in non-perishable food items and, during the holiday season or something like that. And people who can't afford food can go there and get food for their families. Well, the issue you have in Canada now is that these recent immigrants, most of whom are from India, basically just see food banks as an opportunity to get free food, and they're just ravaging the system. And many of these food banks are now running out of food because these immigrants that they're bringing in, none of them would ever in a million years give towards a food bank, but they have absolutely no shame in taking from one. So, this behavior to a Canadian would just be absolutely repulsive, but to people who are bringing into Canada, that's just, they just kind of see it as an opportunity to get ahead. And this is one of the reasons why Canadians are turning against immigration so quickly. But the point I'm trying to make is that it's not simply just the IQ which causes the problem, because I know that people like Musk and these tech bros, it seems like their solution is to target the high IQ immigrants rather than just anyone. And they always talk about this point system. Hey, we've had this point system in Canada for over 50 years, and it's totally useless. It's been a disaster, and our immigration policy is the cause of most of these problems. But there still are going to be these fissures which they're going to have to deal with. Like another issue we have in Canada.
Just hold that thought. Another thing is that I saw these clips of, I don't know if they were Indians or gypsies or whatever, but stealing trick-or-treat sweets from outside people's houses. Just coming in and like funneling them all into a bag and walking away, and then going on to the next house and doing the same. I mean, that is such a breakdown of social trust, because you can say, well, it doesn't really matter. The kids will get over it. They'll get over the disappointment. And it's not that much money. It's not that, I mean, financial value. Sure. But it's social trust. Because why then would that house do the same the next year? Just so that they can get robbed again. I mean, they've destroyed a sort. God, it's really.
I mentioned that thing at the end of my article on food banks, because the point of the title of the article was why Canada can no longer have nice things, and it was about how why food banks are probably going to become a thing of the past. And I mentioned at the end, well, Halloween, maybe that's another thing. So what happened was on Halloween, which I think people should hand out the candy to the kids themselves, but nonetheless. A lot of people would put out a bowl of candy so that kids who come by can help themselves. They can just put a few in their bag. And some houses did that when I was a kid. Most of them handed them out, but some of them would just leave it out there. And we'd only take one or two because, of course, you don't want to be greedy and you want to leave some for other kids. But what happened, and this was in Markham, it's a borough of Toronto, there was this Indian woman who was going around and caught on about a dozen different door cameras picking up these containers of Halloween candy and just dumping them into a sack and claiming all of them for herself. I mean, it's not even the fact that the candy was stolen that's infuriating. It's the fact that it's this nice tradition that you have, one that makes children happy, and you've imported this culture, which is just the total antithesis of what allowed a tradition like that to exist in the first place, and it won't exist if you continue to do that.
And you say, well, that you didn't take all the sweets that were available because, of course, you want to leave some for other kids. You say, of course. Well,
they wouldn't.
Other races don't see it that way. They see it as, who cares? I don't care about the other kids. I want all the sweets. I'm going to take them, even though I'm a grown bloody adult.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they just see it as a way to get ahead, to just scam you. They even have these with these food banks. So one funny story is that, like I mentioned earlier, we had a huge amount of people entering Canada on these student visas, about 40% of them, a huge number of them, are from India, and I'm sure that a huge number of them are also from like Pakistan or Bangladesh or whatever. And I mentioned that these food banks, like they're just being swamped and they're just being they're running out of food. So a lot of these people on student visas, which in order to actually get a student visa, you're supposed to be able to prove that you're financially viable, that you're able to afford living in Canada before you get that visa. Well, that means that you should be able to support yourself. That means you shouldn't have to use a food bank. But these international students, not only will they go to these food banks, they were making these videos in some South Asian language, bragging about having gone to these food banks and getting free food, presumably to encourage their other compatriots to do the same. I mean, it's bad enough that they're taking advantage of the goodwill of others, but it's another to just go on social media and brag about it. I mean, it's just totally revolting behavior for to Canadian sensibilities and to generally just Western sensibilities. But to them, they just seem to have no shame in it. What's the most shocking is just how little shame there is. I have a joke about this in my article, but I don't think I'll repeat it here. Some of these food banks, what they've actually done is that they've said that they won't serve first year foreign students. Now, this is the most politically correct way they can possibly just say that they're not going to serve. They can possibly reduce the amount of Indians that are using the food bank because that's what they're doing. And I know that they could never like just come out and say it, but that's the most politically correct way they can actually do that. Because if you don't do it, you just can't have the food bank. See, it's just going to be ravaged.
Yeah, of course. This is the kind of little thing that you can't legislate for, you can't plan against it, So this is the kind of stuff that makes me think we are simply going to have to live separately, one way or another, whatever it takes, because white people don't and won't want to live like this. When they realize, well, this is what it is to live in a multiracial area. It's just to be low trust, deception, exploitation, abuse, laziness, etc. Whatever else that you... I should be careful about the adjectives that I bring into this, but I just think that what you're talking about here is a great illustration of why, even at the lowest level, white people won't want to live in diverse areas. Once they've had a taste of it, once they know what it's actually like, I think once the awareness of that spreads and becomes sort of just every day, I just don't see why they'll do anything but try desperately to live in all white areas, even if that means setting up an actual state, like an ethno state, because what else is, I mean, what other future is there? Just that we just endlessly get deceived and used by other races. Who the fuck wants to live like that?
And I just to bring this back to what we were talking about earlier about how these tech bros, they seem to be targeting like high IQ. They say they want high IQ immigrants. And a lot of people have been saying that, well, that means that America is going to get a bunch of Indians. These people who I'm talking about in Canada, these international students who are abusing the food bank system, these aren't like the riffraff. I assume that most of them probably come from wealthy families back in India because they're able to afford to send their kids or their family members, whoever it is, they're able to afford to send them to university in Canada.
Imagine if it turned out that one of the people stealing these Halloween candies was actually a tech CEO. AI identified him.
But no, there was actually one where the guy was like, he had like some internship at some bank or something like that. So again, you know, this isn't Africans shooting each other in the streets of Detroit. This isn't, this isn't like Pakistani grooming gangs or anything. This is probably the high end of South Asia that's doing this. Now, unfortunately, it seems like we're getting both the high end and the low end in Canada. But even the ones who are competent in a nominal sense, and like in that they probably have an IQ of 100 or so, they still just don't fit in with the sensibilities. And if these the tech bros think that they're going to be able to just solve all these problems by just that by having kind of high IQ multiracialism, I don't think that's going to work either.
This is the thing. I mean, as you say, it's not just about IQ. It's about the sensibilities, the character, the things that what Sivnats might call the values, which I would actually say are characteristics rather than values. It's not something that people choose. It's just aspects of their nature, which are genetic, and so it's not, it's something that you can't legislate for and you can't acculturate for either. It's going to be there. As you say, these aren't the riffraff. This is the high end of, well, you might say it's the high end of the lower races.
And, you know, there are a few other examples from Canada. So Canada now has bad diplomatic relations with India because pretty much political dissidents I know nothing about India and I don't really care that much about it, but basically political dissidents, I think in Punjab or something like that. So I think Sikhs or whatever, they're basically using Canada as a base of operation. So the leader of our third largest political party is this Sikh Indian guy. As you'd imagine, he's viciously anti-white. Just a week ago, he made this speech about we need diversity programs to replace these mediocre white men. I mean, he's a revolting character, but he basically supports, his name's Jasmeet Singh, if anyone's wondering. So he basically supports open border, cosmopolitan, anti-white progressivism for Canada. But he's this radical Sikh nationalist and separatist. He's part of these organizations, which in India are considered terrorist organizations.
Bloody hell. See, this reminds me of how in Germany the Turks vote hard left within Germany, but then hard right when they vote in Turkish referendums. It's like they're a nationalist for their own people, but for within the white context, they're hard left.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly that. But in this case, this guy's he's even more extreme. It's because in the Turks' case, they're just supporting Erdogan. With this guy, he's supporting violent separatist groups and stuff back in India. Or another example, this was with the Liberal Party. So it's just to get an idea that this is not just one party. Jasmeet Singh was the leader of the NDP party, which is like our center left, but of course they're just insane libtards party. And then the Liberals are supposed to be the centrist party, but this is Justin Trudeau's party, so they're also insane liberals. But he had some minister, I think it was like the former minister of defense or something like that, but it was a Sikh guy. And do you remember in 2021 when there was that evacuation from Kabul when the Americans evacuated Afghanistan?
Yeah.
So this guy, this Canadian, I think he was the defense minister, some Sikh guy, basically he diverted resources which were meant to be used to evacuate Canadian citizens from Kabul. Now, whether or not they were what I would consider to be Canadian, were they actually white Anglo-Saxon, you know, were they actually white Anglo-French Canadians or whatever, or were they actually, you know, Afghans with Canadian citizenship? Well, even putting that point aside, so what this guy did was he diverted resources which were assigned to evacuate Canadian citizens from Kabul while it was being taken over by the Taliban, and he used those resources to evacuate Afghan Sikhs out of Kabul.
Ah, yes, I remember this. Yeah, that rings a bell. I'd forgotten all about this. Yeah, it was ethnocentrism.
100%. Yeah, he just supports his own ethnic group. And now you have all these people in the government. Or like another example is that we have this town. It's the most South Asian place in Canada. It's called Brampton. And a few weeks ago, there were these street fights between Sikhs and Hindus. Yeah, like they're with all their banners and like lighting each other, having fist fights and lighting each other's buildings on fire. And here's the white pill of all this is that these people all hate each other and that I don't think they're actually going to be able to maintain a stable coalition. So like if we take that example, like even the Indians we have in Canada hate each other. So even the diversity from the same country, they just brought their conflicts with them. You also see in Canada that you'll always have these fights between Turks and Armenians. You'll always have these fights between Jews and Arabs over the Israel-Palestine stuff. If we can take any white pill out of that, it's that I don't feel like that coalition, the Rainbow Coalition, is actually a very strong one. It kind of relies on this either white or Jewish. It relies on this white or Jewish liberal
patronage.
Kind of patronage, yeah. It requires these people to hold this entire group together. And as we know, that's a declining demographic. I guess what the white pill would be is that, you know, when you look at that behemoth of the Rainbow Coalition, well, it seems insurmountable, but if you consider the fact that there really isn't that much which holds them together other than their opposition to us, and that there are fissures among them, well, you know, it might not actually be as difficult to defeat as we might have initially thought. But again, you know, that's a bit of optimism, but I don't think we're at that stage yet. But I mean, I guess it just goes back to like the fact that what we're talking about at the beginning, that just nothing in the system is working right now. And I just feel like people in power, I don't think they've changed their worldview or their ideology or anything. They just have this disaster on their hand, which their own actions have created, and they're trying to find some way to deal with it. Of course, they're not going to actually deal with it and reverse the problem, but they're trying to do just anything. And you see with people like the tech bros, and they're not, you know, they're not as to the left as some, as you know, the libtards and the managerial bureaucracy, but they also are trying to deal with this, and their way of dealing with it is kind of drifting towards the center. But of course, I mean, as we've been discussing, I don't think that's actually gonna fix it long term.
So you're saying that the plan was to replace us, but to keep our societies functional in the meantime. And the problem is that too soon our societies have become dysfunctional.
Well, I don't even know if there was the plan, because I think a lot of these people, I don't know what they were thinking. Did they really think that they're going to have a functional society? So I don't know if they really had that plan. I don't know if they actually were expecting society to break down in the way that it has. I mean, maybe some of them thought it would, but I get the sense that a lot of them weren't even expecting this.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm not talking about the people like Elon Musk or the tech bros. I'm talking about, the actual power. Do you think that they're thinking, well, we have to slow down the Great Replacement because it's resulting in dysfunction?
Yes, but I don't think that they were actually expecting that. Although I will say, I think that there are people of kind of two minds. There are those who are just like these resentful anti-white ghouls, and there sure are a lot of them. And they basically just want, their sole ambition is just the destruction of Western civilization, and they don't care about the dysfunction. There are a lot of those people, and then there are more just the delusional ones who actually believe in this John Lennon's imagine. Brotherhood of man, diversity, future. There are people who actually are just true believers in that, and they kind of butt up against each other. So, for example, I find that a lot of people who are the true believers in the John Lennon's Imagine, they turn into these ghouls because they're angry at the fact that they're not getting their dream. They're not getting the utopia which they were promised, and then they lash out by trying to. Basically by trying to torment the white majority because they're not getting what they want. I don't know if people in this camp, though, I don't know if they actually were expecting there to be dysfunction, because I think a lot of them thought that they were just going to have this great society, this wonderful place once they've replaced us.
Yeah. I think for someone like Elon Musk and these other guys like that, I think they were genuinely quite naive about race. And they just didn't realize this, that race is actually a real thing. It matters. Maybe they still don't realize that, but they're thinking it's about culture. So we've got to slow down the mass immigration so that we can integrate these people. Because I see that a lot still, this talk of integrating, foreigners into Western culture. That still is the CivNat, what's the term, like the wet dream, the hope, the great hope is that we can integrate, and that will best happen if they're here legally rather than illegal. So they've still got these stupid distinctions that mean nothing in the end, except our extinction. See, I think what's happened is the powers have realized that there is a, this is happening so fast, or this has been happening so fast, that there is a serious danger of white identitarianism all over the West. And that Trump, unwittingly perhaps, symbolizes that. So does the AfD in Germany and various other, I could name other parties throughout Europe. And so they've concluded we've got to be more subtle about this, and even seem to placate it to some extent, to a very limited extent, just to calm them down, so that to pacify these rowdy whites, so that they'll accept, so that they'll calm down and accept the replacement just more slowly. I think that might be. But of course, I think that's definitely the game with one faction of the elite. And I think another faction of the elite is thinking, look, we just want prosperity. Let's just craft a society that is prosperous. no matter what it takes. That's the Elon Musk type, the what you might call the right-wing globalist type. Whereas the left-wing globalist still wants the great replacement. They're just prepared to do it more slowly. That's what I suspect is going on here. I don't think... I mean, to the extent, I think they are aware of dysfunction and things like the thieving of Halloween sweets and all of that stuff. But I don't think they're really bothered about it. I mean, the competence crisis, yeah, I think the right-wing globalists are bothered about that. Left-wing, not so much. Not so much at all, really. Because the way they see it is they'll be in their gated communities or they'll be in Israel. So it doesn't matter. Their kids won't be raped by Africans. So who cares?
Yeah, so it's important to know that there is this contingent of the elite. I don't think it's all of them, but there is a lot that they're just these suicidal nihilists who just want the destruction of our society because, well, they consider it to be this metaphysical evil, and you know, well, that is one of the contingents. I just really hope that's the one that's losing power, because you know I'm a lot more optimistic about us being able to supplant the Musk types, or just people that are not quite so ideological, the ones who are kind of just they're not our guys, but they're kind of just centrists, and they just want prosperity. Because I think that the issue that they're going to have is that they're not going to be able to actually solve the problems which are afflicting the Western society. But at the same time, though, they actually have an interest in solving those problems. So, I mean, I'm sure that you've run into this issue a lot before, but whenever you argue with a leftist, a lot of times you really, it's kind of a waste of time because there's no common ground. So you can talk about, you can mention about the destruction of traditional homelands of European peoples. Well, they don't care about that. That's what they want. You can talk about the dysfunction. Well, they don't care about that. They want the dysfunction. So any kind of argument you bring up with them, it's kind of moot because their goal is the destruction of our society. And it's really hard to find any kind of commonality with someone like that. Whereas someone who's kind of more towards the center, they're not a white nationalist. They're not a white advocate or anything like that. They might not be motivated by ethnicity or nation or civilization or anything deeper, but they still actually have an interest in stability and in efficiency and in prosperity. And, you know, when their ideas are kind of brought up against ours, then I think it's, you see almost every time that ours end up winning. Now, again, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to win out, but the point is, though, that they actually have incentive. They actually have different incentives, which aren't just the destruction of Western society, which, if I think that that's definitely a step in the right direction. Now, I don't want to overstate that, because I don't think that the Great Replacement is going to end now that Trump is in office the second time. It didn't end the first time he was in office. It's definitely not going to end the second time. But I do think that it's a step in the right direction, not because the people surrounding Trump are our guys. It's because I just think that our guys are more likely to be able to supplant someone like that.
Yeah, yeah. Because you've got the centrist who, in the end, won't be able to solve the problems that he's talking about, that he's pretending to address.
And yeah, but he not only will he not be able to solve the problems, but he actually has an interest in solving the problems. With the crazy leftists, they don't have any interest in solving the problems. With the centrists, they actually do, but they're not going to be able to.
Yeah. Well, that does open gateways. I mean, that's an interesting development. As you say, once you've done away with the ideological reasons for mass immigration, you then have to rely on practical reasons. But even the practical reasons are now becoming nullified, because I saw there have been actually, I think, at least one report recently. I think it was by Migration Watch, but I'm sure there was another one by some academic department in Britain who had the conclusion of their study was that mass immigration actually isn't good for the economy after all. After all the fucking decades that we've heard that it's brilliant for the economy, that this is why we've got to get flooded with non-whites and our culture has to change and all the rest of it. This academic department has now discovered, against all odds, that in fact it's not good for the economy. What would you say about this incredible revelation?
Well, I wouldn't have needed a massive study, and I wouldn't need a PhD in whatever field that they were in to come to that conclusion. But, well, at least they're being honest about that.
I shouldn't be so sarcastic. It is actually interesting that this is coming out, because that has been the sort of fallback position for the centrist. You know, the leftist has said, talked about diversity, multiculturalism, learning from other cultures, and doing away with the false science of race. And so that's been their justification for mass immigration. But the centrist has always said, well, it's probably good for the economy, I guess. But now they can't say that anymore. Well, hopefully they won't be able to say that anymore. And I think this is why the tech bros are talking about high IQ immigration. And this is the danger. You know, if it's Africans with an average IQ of 75 or something, and they're fucking feral and violent and all the rest of it, it's easy to get the public to think, we don't want that. When it's high IQ Indian Brahmins leading tech companies, that's a different thing. But again, you've still got this problem that, okay, let's have the high IQ. I can imagine someone saying, okay, let's have the high IQ tech CEOs, but not the African feral gangs who, you know, rape white women.
Well, like I mentioned with Canada, like a lot of the Indians who are causing problems in Canada now, they are the high IQ types. And well, there is just this total disconnect. And it's not even just the disparity in IQ. There probably isn't much of a disparity, at least among the high end ones. But there still is this massive disparity in the actual mentality. And it's certainly not something which Canadians are happy about. Which is, I mean, it's a relief to see this, because I mean, my God, I felt this way for the better part of the past decade. But anyway, like another thing that I wanted to bring up is that, someone like going back to Elon Musk, his goal of getting to Mars, I think he's very well aware that the competence crisis is a threat to that. But what I don't think he's aware of, though, is that a threat to that is not just the competence crisis, but just the lack of meaning. Because, like, let's say that he does get all these high IQ immigrants from around the world to come to Silicon Valley or wherever it is, Texas, wherever it is they move, and they, you know, they're all these hard workers, and they work in these tech companies, and they're brilliant coders. Well, the problem is the logical conclusion of that is still not a trip to Mars, because what is it all for? I mean, people in the, of course, when Western civilization went to the moon in the 1960s, we actually had a sense, it wasn't just the competence, but we even had like a sense of like civilizational destiny, like the what's called the Faustian spirit. This is us taking that next great leap for mankind. It's not just the material capability and the know-how to do it. It's also having the drive, because I think that this classical liberal race blind high IQ technocratic society, the end result would just be the greatest minds in the world, and because it would be the whole world, like China, India, America, Europe. Well, it would just be them trying to get people to look at ads. It would just be to them trying to figure out the best way that you could sell some more products on Amazon. I don't think that would actually drive our civilization to space exploration, because again, from this materialistic standpoint, is it really efficient to go to Mars? Well, I don't really think it is. I mean, it would cost a huge amount of money, and certainly none of them would ever see that money back in their lifetimes, and you wouldn't see it back for probably several centuries. It actually requires a drive for something greater, and this classic liberal materialistic, just want to go back to the 90s when video games weren't woke mentality, it's vapid. So, you know, maybe it doesn't erode competence the same way that woke managerialism does, but it doesn't necessarily facilitate the drive to greatness.
Well, that's something that I really do think is pretty much exclusive to white people. I think Japanese have a bit of it, but not nearly enough. It's white people who have the Faustian spirit, so to speak. It's white people who want to conquer new territories, who want to break down barriers and so on. I agree. I just don't see. See, I think the Chinese, for example, the only reason that, and I might be speaking out of complete ignorance here, but my gut feeling is the only reason they would have a space program is to rival other countries that already have a space program, and they don't want to be shown up. But left to their own devices, I don't think they would ever have done this. It just doesn't seem to be in their nature. And so when it comes to the long future, about long-term investment that isn't going to see any sort of profit in the, certainly in the short term or the medium term, I think it's only whites who would do this. And even most of them wouldn't approve of it. Even most of them would be thinking, well, what about my local, the public toilet isn't working, the library's shut down. They'd be thinking about that kind of thing. Quite understandably, I've got sympathy for the hobbits as well, as came up in the Walt Bismarck stream. But I do also admire the explorers and the conquerors and the people who go out into the great unknown. And I think it's only us who would produce such individuals and who would craft the infrastructure around them to enable them to do these things. No one else has got much interest in this, I don't think.
Well, there's that famous George Mallory quote, the first man to successfully climb Mount Everest. What he said was, why did he do it? Because it's there. Because it was the tallest mountain in the world, and that he saw it as his basically destiny, that someone must conquer this mountain. That's why he did it. It wasn't to make money. It wasn't for any kind of materialistic goal. It was just for the glory of man conquering the tallest mountain on the planet.
Mm-hmm. That's a challenge that was waiting to be conquered.
Yeah, and this is something which that's totally absent from this kind of technocratic, classic, liberal, the nihilistic worldview, which is kind of now coming into conflict with the woke managerial one. Now, again, like I think that the woke managerial one is like a lot worse, but the other one, I mean, there are problems with it as well. And I don't want to write the former off as defeated, because it's far from the case. But even if they do get their way, they're certainly not going to be able to solve all of these problems. And if Musk dreams of getting to Mars, it's not simply having enough high IQ people to do it. You actually have to have a drive to do that. Because, have you read the novel Brave New World? For example,
I haven't. I know. I obviously know the storyline, but no, I haven't read it.
Well, I mean, like the idea in the novel is not that mankind, this dystopian novel, it's not that mankind is impoverished or anything like that. It's that they have too much stuff, but it's just that it's all vapid. It's just like, breeding humans to be these perfect units who are just going to be like placated with having all their appetites just satisfied constantly. But the human spirit is totally gone. That seems to be like where the whole tech bro crowd would end. That's where they would end up. But I don't feel like, I mean, someone like Mark Zuckerberg, I could see him actually wanting something like that. I could see him wanting a future where everyone's just hooked up to the metaverse or something like that. Don't know if I get that sense with all of them though. But anyway, I mean, speaking of dystopian fiction, I did actually write an article this year, which I think it's one that's worth getting into. So. And what inspired me to write it was the Southport riots in Britain. So I guess I'll let you fill everyone in, since you're the British guy, and you probably know a lot more about it than I do. But I guess for anyone who either doesn't remember or hasn't heard, what happened in Southport this year?
Well, a Rwandan who was called a Welshman killed three little girls and injured, I think, 10 others. At a dance class, and in response to that, the working class community around that area, this was in Southport, just near Merseyside, near Liverpool, and the working class community rioted and protested about mass immigration being imposed on their area. I think that's is there any more to it than that that is relevant to this?
Well, yeah, that's basically it. And then there was this huge crackdown, and then a bunch of them were thrown in jail for either participating or even making posts on social media.
Yeah, or being present at the riots and so on.
You know, but,
yeah.
Yes. Well, what stood out to me is that it's not the first time this has happened, but on social media, everyone was talking about George Orwell's 1984. And I mean, it's kind of become a cliche. You almost cringe when you hear people bring up 1984 at this point. Do you feel that way? Like that joke, 1984 was a warning, not an instruction manual. It's just stale at this point. We've heard it so many goddamn times. It's not even funny anymore.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, I thought of that. Like, why is it that 1984 is one of the most popular books in the world today? It's one of the most talked about works of fiction. And every time something like this happens, it's always brought up. But why is it that something like 1984 doesn't actually prevent real dystopias? And like, I even made a list of various things which you could apply to the Southport murders and the ensuing fiasco. I thought of multiple things from 1984 which could be applied to this. And yet none of this ever registers more broadly. So, for example, like the idea that a guy from Rwanda is now Welsh, there's newspeak there. Rewriting history, saying that Britain has always been diverse. That's obviously a lie, but there's rewriting history. There's another thing from 1984. The memory hole. So the crime itself was forgotten about within days, and then the entire focus was on the far right overshadowing the crime. Well, the crime was memory hold. 2 minutes of hate, well, the fear-mongering about the far-right boogeyman and about blaming the failures of multicultural on the far-right. Doublethink, the people who the same libtards who supported Black Lives Matter, they got on their knees for a man who died in a different country, but then they don't feel the same way about three white children being murdered in their own country. Thought crime, being arrested for social media posts. Like all of these are things out of 1984, and I'm not trying to put this forward as like this brilliant social commentary on my part. My point is that this is so obvious. Like this observation has been made time and time again, but it doesn't actually have any effect. And there's this huge portion of the population who have no doubt read something like 1984, who are they'll go along with this. They will buy into every single one of these and.
Let me just interject and say that during COVID, this was a huge thing as well.
Oh, exactly. Because you could go down the list.
There were so many parallels with 1984 there, about ruling by fear, rewriting information, presenting information in an obviously distorted way, requiring double think of people, just irrational stuff. The hate group that you're allowed and encouraged to hate. All of that stuff, the rituals, the suffering and the dignity in suffering and the sense that you're doing your duty by suffering. There are just so many.
Yeah, and I even
and I think people always, the question was always, why can't people see it? If they've read 1984, everyone is familiar with it, or you don't even need to have read it. I mean, to know Big Brother is watching you, doublethink, thought crime, etc.
Oh yeah, I only got around so to reading deeply it this year.
That it's amazing that people didn't see they themselves were getting caught up in and manipulated in exactly the same way as the populace in 1984. Sorry, you go.
Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't even read the book until this year, but I already knew about all these concepts. I've known about these concepts for the last 5-6 years already. And, you know, I wanted to ask, like, well, why is it that people who have read this book, who know full well about this, they can't see it in the real world? And I think that the answer is that it comes down to legitimacy. So in a fictional novel like 1984, Big Brother, The Party, Ingsoc, all of this stuff is written with the message in mind that this is dystopian, that this rule is illegitimate, and the reader doesn't actually put any credence into Big Brother or Ingsoc or whatever it is in the story. So they're able to see it as illegitimate because that that authority holds no clout. But when it comes from an authority which does hold clout, the mainstream media, the government, the education system, then they just accept it uncritically, not because they've actually contemplated the validity of the argument that diversity is our strength, for that matter, but because it comes from a position of authority. So it's all about legitimacy, and it's nothing about like this rationally analyzing the systems which rule over you. And that's why, you know, you'll get these people who will read these dystopian fictions, and they are incapable of actually applying it to the world around them. So, you know, this is why, I mean, the thesis of my first one is that dystopian fiction doesn't prevent dystopia. Then the next part was about how some dystopian fiction actually facilitates dystopia.
Before you go into that, let me just present my favorite meme about the NPC. This is the normie who just has no interest in understanding the world around him. He just wants to grill and watch football. I just think this is a hilarious meme. I've brought it, I think this is the third time I've shown it during this millennial, so I apologize to anyone who's bored of it by now, but I think it's hilarious. But anyway, Endeavor, how does the fictional dystopia enable the real life one?
Well, I think it's by basically, the way that dystopian fiction has actually enabled real dystopia is that ideas contrary to the system have been painted as dystopia. So whenever we think of the phrase dystopia, our mind always snaps to 1930s Germany and sometimes Russia. So you always imagine some jackbooted officer with some cap smacking someone with a baton. You think of political banners everywhere. You think of these slogans, some great leader and everything like that. We have this kind of very cliched image of dystopia in our mind, and that's our only way of understanding it. But then not only that, but it's also what you see with the entertainment industry in recent years, and actually going back quite a few decades now. They've constantly portrayed any idea contrary to that of, to wokeism, as just to use a short phrase, that contrary to this universalist egalitarianism, that necessitates dystopia. So the example I primarily used in the second essay was the 2005 film V for Vendetta. Did you have the misfortune of seeing that one?
No, by that time I had already stopped watching films, so I missed that one.
Oh Jesus, it's horrible. Like, it's basically this like libtard power fantasy. So it takes place in a dystopian future Britain ruled by this neo-fascist Christian fundamentalist white supremacist regime who goes around arresting homosexuals and Muslims and anyone who criticizes the government, and it's just ridiculous. Because, you know, what's fascinating about it is how it's just a total inversion of the UK today. So like you can have plenty of examples. Like they have this thing in the movie about this priest who has who's like exploiting young girls. Well, you know, you have Pakistani Muslims doing that in Britain. You have you have this part about them, like white Christian fascists doing these medical experiments on innocent people. Well, you know, it's not white Christian fascists doing it. It's things like the Tavistock Center with the transgenderism agenda. It's not that they have the white Christian fascists like banning literature and everything. Well, it's these radical feminists and anti-racists who are trying to rewrite Agatha Christie or Ian Fleming. I mean, you can just go down the list. I even wrote a huge list.
I can give three examples of this from other things. There was a TV show in Britain called Spooks in the mid to late 2000s, I think. And it was about the Secret Service, the security services, a sort of thriller thing. But very frequently they would have the bad guys, the terrorist group that's being investigated. It would be white people, and it was almost never Muslims. But everyone knew that what the truth is, that it's I don't know how to say this. The far right is a bogeyman created by the establishment in order. It's like a dystopia that they've made up. They've made up this villain. They've manufactured it so as to misdirect the public. And meantime, they're misdirecting the public away from the real danger, which is Islamist terrorism. And that's the whole point of that program, was just to misinform the public. There was another one, the girl with the pearl earring or whatever it was called. Those books were written by a communist. I think he was Swedish. And again, I don't know the details of this, but someone in the chat probably will. But I remember reading a summary where, again, it was a total inversion, where white men were sex trafficking foreign girls, like non-white girls, and raping them, all this. Total inversion of the actual reality. But this is the fiction that liberals will read and assume to be reflecting the truth.
Yeah, and a lot of this, or remember that one, The Handmaid's Tale? I mean, how many times have you seen those stupid red robe, white hood, whatever, that stupid, like, yeah, and well, you know, the point is that...
There's another one that I want to give, because it's more subtle and more interesting, because it's from a long time ago. This is really interesting. It's something I'm going to talk about when I write the essays about the history of British comedy. God, what were they called? It was the ones who, it was not the, let me get this right. Alan Bennett. It was a troupe of comedy troupe who, what were they called? Someone will know in the chat. Can anyone tell me? Alan Bennett, the four of them, there was four guys, and it was in the early 60s. And they were regarded as very highbrow, yeah, beyond the fringe. Satirical reviews. So it was Dudley Moore, Jonathan Miller, who was Jewish, and Peter Cook and Alan Bennett. And so this is seminal British. It was pre-Monty Python. It was pre-everything. All the stuff that we talk about now. This was like the granddaddies of it. And they're all dead now, except for Alan Bennett. But anyway, I watched one of their shows, and it was actually awful. It was just so boring. I couldn't believe that it had ever been popular. But anyway, at one point in this, it's the four guys, and they're on stage, and they're chatting, and it's a fictitious conversation they're having, where the four characters, effectively. And one of them says he's been to America recently, and another one says, oh, yes, what's the politics like there? The Republicans, they're the conservative party, aren't they? And he said, yes, yes. And the other one says, but who are the liberal party? And the other one says, there isn't a liberal party. Right?
And what decade was this made in?
The early 60s. Oh, now, geez. It's so interesting, because that's setting up the highbrow, educated viewer of that is going to watch that and chuckle away, have a good fucking smug, self-satisfied titter to himself that, oh, yes, well, of course, there's no liberalism in America. They're all bigots, really. And the opposite is the truth. The opposite is the truth, that even the Republicans were liberal then, and the Democrats were certainly liberal then. And America was on a liberal trajectory. As my previous guest said, at that point, they had already done desegregation, and they were about to do the Civil Rights Act in that era. So the idea that it wasn't a liberal, that there just wasn't any entree for liberalism into American politics, was absolute fiction.
Yeah, like, but another
highbrow would take it for granted, because they've seen it on Beyond the Fringe. They've seen these four very intelligent, educated men saying this. So therefore, it must be the truth. And this is how dystopia is enabled by fiction in one way.
Well, you know, there's also that trope you'll hear from libtards in America. They'll often say, don't you know that the Democrats in America basically would be right-wingers in Europe? It's just ridiculous. Like the implication is that even the Democrats are to the right of
yes,
of European right wing parties, which it's obviously
utter nonsense. I mean, it may be true in regard to the provision of welfare services, but even then, I don't really think so. I mean, yeah, it's, they've been providing welfare services to the black population of America very plentifully. So even that is a lie. They're, in the ways that matter, the right wing are left wing and the left wing are right wing, in all the ways that actually matter.
I wanted to get back to V for Vendetta, because I even saw people mentioning that, and these were some like right leaning people, and I couldn't believe it. They were saying like that when the Southport riots were going on, they said V for Vendetta tried to warn us. I'm like, are you mad? The good guys in V for Vendetta, they share the beliefs of the people of the people who are arresting people for social media posts. So what's funny is that the quote unquote fascist regime in V for Vendetta, that was basically just the values of Britain before the 1960s. This was the values of Britain which George Orwell wrote 1984 and 1948. So, you know, the people who he had in mind that he would write 1984 as this horror story of unimaginable dystopia, they were the one, their values that these people held, that's the values that the movie V for Vendetta is trying to convince you would create this totalitarian fascist regime. Even though back then, no one was being arrested for hate speech. No, there were no grooming gangs. There was nobody being shipped off to some like twisted medical experiment, transgender Tavistock Center, whatever it is. None of that was around. But this movie's trying to portray that as dystopian.
Yeah, it's similar to how people will say nowadays that the Allies who fought the Nazis, they did so for the world of today. They when actually in the ways that matter, the Allies, like the Allied soldiers, were very similar to the Nazi soldiers. I mean, in terms of their worldview, in terms of their view on race, on the roles of men and women, on homosexuality, feminism, the average Allied soldier was a complete fascist by today's standards.
Well, I mean,
indistinguishable from the Nazi soldier.
The Prime Minister of Canada at the time, William Lyon Mackenzie King, he explicitly said that Canada was a white country, and it's not implicit. He full on said that Canada should not allow immigration from Asia in order to maintain the European character of the country. This was Canada's prime minister at the time. So the idea that they went to war to fight racism, it's just couldn't be further from the truth. But you know what these like libtard dystopian fictions really do is people have to understand that they're not a critique of authoritarianism. Something like V for Vendetta, it's not criticizing the idea of having a big government or a surveillance state or persecuting political enemies. In fact, I mean, in the movie, the guy goes around killing his political enemies. The message of the movie is that if anybody questions anything which is contrary to this universalist egalitarianism, that's bound to result in genocide, and any amount of force used against such person is justified because you're preventing that. So
it's
and then
Vosh.
That.
It's Vosh advocating a sort of muscular liberalism that just kills the enemies of liberalism.
That's the message of V from Vendetta. The message is not that censorship is bad, or big governments, or even like some big fascist leader. Well, I mean, I wouldn't call him fascist, some big authoritarian leader. The message isn't that that's bad. The message is that it's bad to not be a libtard, and that anybody who isn't basically is going to bring about this genocide or whatever, and it justifies you to use any force against them necessary. And that's how you get things like Antifa. That's how you get things like these hate speech laws and people getting thrown in jail for social media posts.
Yeah, I was going to say the people who jerked off to V for Vendetta 20 years ago, because I think it was 2005, are the same people who will cheer on the hate speech laws, mass immigration, diversity quotas, and of course the COVID rules and provisions and so on. So they don't actually have. See, the thing is, nobody actually has a problem with authority when it's doing what they want it to do. Then everyone's delighted. This goes for even the people who, 20 years ago, when that film came out, were portraying themselves as, you know, the friend of humankind, the friend to everyone, the person who just wants everyone to get along, and openness and friendliness and so on. They can be, and we've seen this recently. We've seen this with the, as I say, the likes of Vosh. They can be extraordinarily authoritarian. And I mean, who are all the people 5 years ago who were smugly saying, just build your own Twitter? But it's the very same people who would have been just loving V for Vendetta.
Oh, 100, yeah, 100%. And they'll never see any irony. They'll never see any irony in that, because ultimately the message is the message isn't that authoritarianism is bad. And, you know, what you see with, like you said, nobody ever has any problem with authoritarianism when it's being used in their favor. Anyway, do you think we should hit the super chats? I don't want to eat time of the next.
Sorry, I was enjoying the conversation so much that I somewhat.
Well, no problem. I was too. So I just don't want to take up the any time from the next.
Yes,
stream,
yes,
so
you're quite right. You're quite right. Okay, Night Nation Review, who was on previously, said, "I love Endeavor. He makes great videos. Great lineup, Woz. Thanks again for having me on." Well, thank you very much, Nick, and you are very welcome. I appreciate that super chat. Darby said, "Really enjoyed Endeavor's Canada and the Faustian Spirit. Was a beautiful video. Please do more of that off the cuff in nature, Morgoth style."
Well, I'm glad you liked that one. It wasn't exactly off the cuff. I actually wrote down what I wanted to say, but thanks for enjoying that one.
Okay. Darby, Trudeau and the Liberals here are actually telling the public over 5 million temporary workers or foreign students whose visa are about to expire will actually just go home. Yeah, we addressed this earlier. I don't think that's going to happen. I think that's an empty promise, so to speak.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen, but I do hope some of them go home.
Yeah. Alt-White said, "We must secure the existence of our people, white homelands now." Yes, I agree. I agree indeed. Alt-White again said, "Historically, 90+% of all scientific, technological, philosophical, and social advancements have come from white Europeans. Meritocracy works great for us." Well, that's true, and that's a note of optimism there in terms of the age of merit that we might be about to enter. Diesel Runaway said, "This interview has made the maniacal pre-Christmas cleaning feel so much more bearable." Well, I'm glad. I thought it was quite an intense conversation, but I'm glad it's helped you out. Pebble in the Pond said, "Haven't been able to watch live as much as I wanted to this year, but glad to catch Endeavor live. Always look forward to Millennial." Well, great. Thank you very much. And you know, you can always catch up in January. I'm trying to tag each stream with topical or evergreen. So that will help people to choose which ones they should watch first. But that isn't visible yet on the website. I'll implement that probably on Christmas Day when I've got some time off. The Woodlander says, "Always enjoy Endeavor's input. Intelligent and coherent. Thank you, Woz." Thank you very much, Woodlander. And Darby says, "Wishing Woz and Endeavor a Merry Christmas. I always look forward to this stream. Is there any place in Canada that either of you haven't been to that you would like to visit?" I haven't been to Canada at all, so I am curious to visit. I'd like to see Toronto just so that I can see where The Fly was filmed, but that's a nerdy thing of my own. Endeavor.
Well, I'm from Toronto. I don't know where The Fly was filmed, but, you know, I wouldn't recommend it. It's not on the high, on the top of my list, but maybe if it's something to see.
I've heard it's got great diversity.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the official slogan of the city. The slogan of the city is diversity, our strength. Yeah, wonderful stuff. Anyway, where would I like to see in Canada, which I haven't seen? I'm going to say Newfoundland. So I've been to 7 provinces. I haven't been to any of the territories. The three I haven't been to are Newfoundland, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba. So Newfoundland would be my choice. Probably St. John's and then just the rest of the province.
Right, okay. And Unit Tactics said, Indians being high IQ is one of the biggest hoodwinks of the 21st century. He then says something about them, which I won't read out, but it's rather negative as a critical comment about their nature. And then he says, and only the gullible fall for their bullshit. They should be strongly opposed. Well, look, I agree, right? I'm not laughing at what you're saying. It's just the strident tone is kind of it's fun. But yeah, I agree. As Endeavor and I said earlier, none of this is good for white people, and we don't need anyone else. That's what it comes down to. Okay, and then there's a $5 donation from Ian. Thank you for that. And Unit Tactics again said, Trump and the AFD are nothing more than a release valve. Any political party that is not actively advocating for whites is not for whites. They are against them. Maybe I wouldn't say so. I don't know. I've just got a feeling about the AFD. I might turn out to be wrong. Maybe it's copium. I don't know. Endeavor, what's your gut feeling about the AFD?
You know, I don't know enough about German politics to say one way or the other. So I think I'll pass on the question. I just don't feel comfortable answering it because I'm not the authority on it. About Trump. Well, I think he's more of like a relief valve for certain segments of the elite class, that being big tech and then the more right-leaning segments of the Zionist lobby, that he's going to kind of just give them what they want. He's not going to give the people what they want. And I don't think he's actually going to relieve much of the problem. I think he's more just kind of a release valve for certain segments of the elite, that they can kind of get some breathing room from the woke managerialism that's just been that, you know, they now kind of see coming in conflict with some of their interests. I will say that one thing that is depressing is it is annoying how MAGA, it's just this aesthetic, which has really no substance. So when you look at Trump and how I think he's actually going to rule, I don't think it's going to be populism at all, but you know, he has this populist aesthetic, which he doesn't even believe in. And unfortunately, it just still gets a bunch of people to love the guy for some reason. Well, I mean, I understand why. It's because, unfortunately, normies are just driven by that. Just because, you know, he has that image, get a lot of people to support him.
Well, next millennial, we'll be able to talk about his first year, and it should be interesting.
That'll be interesting,
Yeah, how much has come to pass. Andy said, sorry if this was already covered, but it wasn't, so don't worry. But what does Endeavor think about Maxime Bernier and the PPC?
I've said some positive things about the PPC, and I actually do like Maxime Bernier. He has pushed the envelope in some ways. So he has actually said that he would support a moratorium on immigration. And, you know, he has pushed a lot of the talking points, which people in our sphere have been pushing for years. So in some ways, I think the guy's heart is in the right place. And secondly, he was also really good during COVID. So he actually was against it from the beginning. Yeah. So he did actually take a stand on that issue. The problem is that the PPC, they're trying to be this kind of nativist nationalist party, but they believe in all these stupid classic liberal values. And now they're just allowing a bunch of migrants to join their party, a bunch of non-whites to join their party, and they're not gonna pursue that agenda. So, for example, there was this one guy who was this Hindu ethno-religious activist who was in the Conservative Party who got kicked out because he was just too ethnocentric, and it was pretty clear that was his entire goal. And the Conservative Party is not a nationalist party by any stretch. But he was too over the top for even them. But the PPC let him join the party. And do you think this guy is going to actually, you think he's going to support deportations? Do you think he's going to support a moratorium on immigration? It seems doubtful. So the problem they have is that they're not taking a stand on the fundamental issues, because they hold these like idiotic classic liberal beliefs that just like, well, anything goes. Well, anyone can join our party. We're about ideas. Now, they have pushed some actually decent policies, but this stupid classic liberalism is basically just allowing the party to be infiltrated by people who aren't going to who aren't going to take the party in that direction. You either have to be in favor of you either have to just be a nativist party, or if or don't be one. Because if you actually want to be one, you have to keep people like this out of the party. But they don't seem to want to do this because they seem to think, well, the more support, the better. But in doing so, they're just sacrificing the actual message. So, I mean, I still think they're their best bet. I'll vote for them in the next election, but I don't know. I think they kind of seem to be going the same way as Reform in the UK, which is a shame.
It really does seem that there's a clamor for hard line on immigration in all these countries, and it is being stymied by the parties that are extant in those countries. So it's sort of, they're always cucking, basically. That still seems to be the way that this is dealt with. They might say some things, like some red meat comments, but their policies and the people that they take on are still basically pro mass immigration. Definitely not pro white. That seems to be.
There was this guy who was some not even Canadian citizen, some like guy from, I forget, it was like Cameroon or something like that. And they had in the bio that, oh, he has interactions with diverse communities of Canadian communities here and abroad, Canadians abroad, this Cameroonian guy or whatever. And it's like, are you going to actually allow, you're going to allow this guy into your party, and you're going to, and this idea that, well, oh, we just want them, anyone can sign up. Well, the more the merrier, we're about values. Well, this, I highly doubt that this guy's actually going to, support the message which people associate with the People's Party, and I highly doubt he really even cares about your values either. So, it's frustrating. Sorry for cutting you off there.
Nobody really cares about values except for center-right white people who really need to wake up. As I say, I think there's an appetite for mass deportation, remigration, whatever, and total end to non-white immigration. There's an appetite for that, and it is not being answered by the political parties really anywhere.
And they keep talking.
Yeah. And then finally, Ghost Dog Man said, this was on Rumble, a Rumble rant, this was a masterclass in a conversation about civics, our civics. Thank you for gifting us this exemplar this Christmas season. Well, thank you very much, Ghost Dog Man. I do my best, and so does Endeavor. So thank you for that compliment. All right. Well, I guess that's it. I've really enjoyed this conversation, Endeavor. I think it's been a good one, and I think other people, there have been lots of positive comments, so I think it's been popular. Is there anything you want to say before we finish?
No, I guess just congratulations on the 10 years of Millennia Yule. It's been a blast every year that I've been on, and it's kind of just becoming a mainstay for our guys, and I think we need things like that. It's become a cultural experience now. You know, we don't want all of our culture to be on the internet, but we have the internet, so we might as well use it. So, Merry Christmas to all, Happy New Year, and I hope to be back again next year.
Yes, you will be. Thank you very much for those kind words, and I'm glad that Millennial is a part of many people's festive season. All right, well, I will be back in about 5 minutes with JF, but in the meantime, Endeavor, thank you for appearing on Millennial X.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The festival goes on, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the lights on.